Good morning, Ramona Koval here with The Book Show on ABC Radio National. This morning, a panel of experts talks to me about storytelling and writing in the field of computer games. More and more games are exploring sophisticated narrative elements as film-savvy players expect more in terms of character development and storyline. So we'll find out about all of that this morning and about the role that writers are having in this exciting new interactive world. But first up, congratulations to Roger MacDonald, who last night was awarded the Miles Franklin Award for his book, The Ballad of Desmond Cale. And commiserations, too, to Roger MacDonald for being somewhat overshadowed by the 2-2 draw match for the Socceroos versus Croatia. I must admit that since Helen Demidenko won it that year, it takes a bit of the shine off the Miles Franklin for me. However, good on Roger, good on the others on the shortlist, and good on the Socceroos. Video games have come a long way since games like Donkey Kong and Pac-Man and Pong, that game where you hit a ball against a wall, a sort of rudimentary electronic ping pong, really, since those were introduced to lounge rooms in the 70s. Far from that archaic world, 30 years on now, players are able to immerse themselves in very sophisticated virtual worlds where they can choose how their characters dress or how they interact with others. And that's just the beginning. Choice is the new buzzword in gaming circles. Cutscenes have also become more prevalent. They are 1 or 2 minute 3D animated film clips which appear from time to time, which advance the plot and present character development. Players have now come to expect this level of storytelling in games. They want complex characters with detailed personal histories. It's no longer a case of shoot him because he's a bad guy. Players now want to know the motives behind the character's actions. But despite this progress being made in the storytelling aspect of games, what do we know about the people who write for this medium? And as we move towards an even more technology-saturated future, will games become one of the more important vehicles for telling stories? Before I introduce our guest this morning, just to illustrate what we're talking about today, these so-called cutscenes or film clips, here's a grab from Resident Evil, which is an action game about a renegade fighting a huge corporation who've accidentally generated an army of zombies, as you do.
The American Midwestern town, Raccoon City, has been completely decimated due to the T-virus outbreak that was instigated by the international corporation Umbrella. Claire Redfield, who arrived in Raccoon City to search for her lost brother Chris, and a rookie police officer, Leon S. Kennedy, managed to escape from the city. But their ordeal was only a prelude of things to come. Three months later,
identification number is WKD4496. Welcome to your new home.
Her name is Claire Redfield. We caught her trespassing in our Paris lab facility 10 days ago. She apparently infiltrated the complex looking for her lost brother, Chris Redfield, one of the surviving members of RPD's famous STARS teams.
Well, Raccoon City and the International Corporation Umbrella. Doesn't that guy sound like George W. Bush? Well, he did to me. That was a cutscene from the game of Resident Evil. Hearing a bit of the plot there. As I've mentioned, these scenes are dispersed throughout the games to advance the play. And now to introduce our guests who are here to discuss narratives in video games. Mark Angeli, he's a video game writer and director whose career stretches back almost 20 years, starting with traditional tabletop role-playing games and moving forward to directing some of the latest cutting-edge releases. He's the co-founder of a game design consultancy called The Game Mechanics. And Jan Nabokowski, who's been an avid gamer since first switching on a TRS-80, one of the first home computers. He's currently working as a freelance writer for Space Dog, an LA-based development house specialising in producing comics and adapting them to other media, like video games. And finally, welcome from our Sydney studios to Mark Pesci. He's a 3D graphics expert and is the author of 5 books and numerous articles, including The Playful World, which discusses how children interact with and learn from technology. And from 2003 to 2006, he chaired the Emerging Media and Interactive Design Program at the Australian Film, Television and Radio School in Sydney. And in February, he received an appointment as an honorary associate at the University of Sydney and has gone on to found Future Street, a Sydney media and technology consultancy. Welcome to all of you, gentlemen. Jan, can I start with you? You've been playing video games for your entire life. From the 1980s. What was the first video game you fell in love with?
I can't tell you what it was called.
Because you couldn't read?
Oh, no, I could read, but I can't remember what it was called, and it was just a black screen with sort of green vector graphics, and all you did was fly through space infinitely and shoot spaceships. But I remember that one player could control the spaceship and the other could shoot, and so I remember all these to play that as often as we could, and it was kind of my first experience of this weird world where we could both interact with something, and yeah, we used to play it hours and hours, and homework would fly by the wayside.
What about you, Mark? You've spent a long time creating these games. How advanced are the games now from the one that we've just heard about?
In specifically storytelling terms, you mean? They're significantly advanced. It used to be completely acceptable to just say, the princess has been kidnapped, you have to kill Donkey Kong to get her back. And now, unless it's a very basic game, players don't accept that anymore. So I guess it's kind of like the difference between the first films, which were little 12-minute shorts about a bank robbery, and the kind of cinema we've got now. It's actually been a much sharper curve than cinema, but I think the issue is that we haven't gone as far as we need, or the industry hasn't gone as far as it needs to. And it's also gone in a bad direction, I think, but we can get into that.
Yeah, well, we'll investigate that in a moment. But, Mark, just on this term gaming, Mark Pesci, we associate this, you know, with the whole culture now. I mean, it's not just Jan in his lounge room with his first computer. There's a whole gaming culture now. What is it?
Well, there is, and there's different kinds of gaming cultures. We think of the sort of big-name games that you see advertised on the telly that run on the big platforms by, you know, like the Xbox and the PlayStation and things like this as being gaming. In fact, that's actually a relatively restricted part of the market. There's a much larger market for casual gaming, as they call it, which are simple games, maybe card games or classic board games, things like this. And, of course, the rules for those and the stories around those in some ways are older and simpler. And we also now see this happening in the market, and I think Mark and Jelly will probably talk about this too, which is that we see the big platforms, Sony and Microsoft, going in one direction, and they're trying to fulfill this idea of the gaming platform as a movie studio. And then you have Nintendo going in another direction saying, well, no, really it's about fun and moving your body and just doing simple things, but doing them really well, and that the joy of the game is in the play rather than the story. And so what we're seeing is that there's a real tension here, and it's a creative tension. It's a good thing. But there's a tension between these two ideas of what a game is and what gamers are.
All right, talking about what gamers are, what about who gamers are? Because we've got 3 gentlemen talking to me today. Are women involved in storytelling and the gaming and, you know, the whole culture of gaming?
Well, to a degree, I mean, there's a fair assessment that it is, particularly at the sort of higher end, what are called the AAA games, that these are really aimed at men. But there are some very notable exceptions. One of arguably the most popular games of all time, The Sims, attracts primarily women players. And Sims is a game world, if you can think of it, where living your life in this world, in the Sim world, is the story that you're telling. And so there's something about that that's rather than blowing up aliens or spaceships or whatever, that kind of storytelling seems much more appealing to women. although men do enjoy it.
It sounds a bit boring, though, the way you're putting it. Just living your life. What, just going to the shops and stuff instead of killing people?
There is a really good joke, which was that I stayed up until 3 in the morning making sure that my Sims weren't tired for work.
What is it? I don't get that.
You play it and be late for work, so make sure that your online life is...
Your little Sims are actually healthier than you are.
Than you are, and have better social interactions.
Are they like children or what?
It's like a community. You have a house and a man and a woman.
I meant little as in on the screen. They're quite small.
So it's sort of like just a little house that we used to play with teacups and stuff.
It's interesting.
And dolls or what? Is it kind of dolls for the 21st century?
They have their own lives and their own desires.
They make love and have children. And,
yeah. and if you mistreat them, they'll commit suicide.
Oh, God. Yeah.
This
is for fun.
It's interesting that Mark should bring that up as an example of something that reaches a broader market than the usual male-centred market, because The Sims also doesn't have a story or cutscenes.
So you guys sound like you wouldn't be playing Sims.
No, I...
You like it?
Well, I don't play a lot of computer games, video games, to be brutally honest, but I
certainly... Even though you write them.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't... I'd certainly play that as much as anything else. It wouldn't be my favourite genre, but no, I think it's doing great stuff, and I enjoyed the little bits that I've played.
There's a bit of a differentiation here, again, between games which allow you to create your own story, which is what something like The Sims is like, or something like Resident Evil or Half-Life or things like this, where there's a very strong external storyline, and you have to obey that storyline in order to participate in the game.
Look, Mark, can I ask you, Mark Angeli, which elements of games need a writer? I mean, does the writer, like a playwright or a screenwriter, get involved with the whole storyboarding of the game, you know, the whole, you know, every scene from go to woe? Or are writers like yourself brought in just to write the cut scenes, the short film scenes?
Okay, there's two kinds of writing. Well, I mean, yeah, two broad parameters of writing within video games. One is the gameplay, which is called game design, which is a bad term for it, but that's what they call it. And the other one is the narrative, which can be delivered through cutscenes or in-game dialogue or found objects in the game. I write both. Generally, the problem with the industry is people who write both, because you get either a game designer who has no clue about narrative, has never studied cinema, because it's a very similar visual narrative to cinema, and you end up with terrible cutscenes and bad storylines.
And what's a terrible cutscene?
Almost all of them. I mean, the worst
You're
example.
Negative today.
the worst example of a cutscene, and it's a very common example, is something that interrupts the gameplay for too long, which a lot of them are, and shows you all the cool stuff, but doesn't let you do any of it.
I think that the one that's quite common and it's very frustrating is when you first switch on the game and then have to sit through 20 minutes of a cutscene before you're allowed to do anything.
And you hear from gamers all the time that this is the thing that drives them crazy. A lot of gamers want to turn on the game and start playing the game. In a sense, the backstory, the reason that they're there, is not as important to them, and yet they're being forced by the auteurs who are creating the games to sit through these scenes.
Now, what the auteurs who are creating the games, does that mean, you know, people like you, Mark Angeli, you want people to know what the story is, because that's what your job is?
Well, hang on, yes, I do. But the thing is that myself and the industry are on opposite sides of the river, and, you know, I've lost jobs because of it. I believe that some games absolutely don't need a story, and even games that are story-heavy need less story than we currently have. If you can't deliver it, if you've got a fantastic story that requires a lot of telling, then you need to write a book or make a film. Because the purpose of, I mean, to use a specific example, if you're making a Star Wars game, blowing up the Death Star should not be in a cutscene. You should be playing that bit.
You should blow it up yourself.
Yeah, exactly. But you'd be surprised how common that error is in the industry. They show you the exciting stuff and you play the boring stuff. So I'm constantly saying to clients and developers and publishers and everybody, we need less story here. We need to deliver it quickly. And some games don't need it. I've talked myself out of work because games don't need a story, certain games. You don't need any more than the princesses in the castle kill Donkey Kong.
Yeah, and from a user's point of view, how important to the overall game experience are these cutscenes or film clips? What do they add to
the game? It really depends on the sort of game. I think that I remember that Blizzard's StarCraft game had fantastic cutscenes that had absolutely nothing to do with the story, and they were simply there for theme, and to show you what the rest of the world was like, so that the next time you got to play, you kind of understood what was going on. But a lot of the times people do forget that it is a game and there needs to be gameplay involved. And something like Tetris, which was the most popular game of all time, doesn't need cutscenes, it doesn't need a story, and it's going to suck people in. So I think there definitely needs to be a balance.
On the other hand, one of the best examples I've seen of a narrative really working in a game is the opening of Half-Life 2, where you're basically being ushered into a prison facility. And you go through these scenes, and you're feeling very cramped, and the guards are being mean to you. And then you go into this final room, and there's a chair, and there's blood on the walls, and you realize you're about to be tortured. And this is the first time when I'd ever been playing one of the sort of the new, very realistic games, where I had that absolute sense of horror and fright, as if I were basically a first-person participant in a film, where I was like, oh my God, I've got to get out of here. And I realized when we'd crossed that threshold that the storytelling capability had now gotten behind the idea of the game rather than fighting it.
I just want to say, ask Mark, though, how boring would that scene have been if you weren't in control of the character, and how detached from it would you have felt?
When you say in control of the character, you
actually,
what do you mean?
Because you actually get to play the character, and it is
it is you.
You are fairly being funneled into this room.
Half-Life 2 did an interesting thing where instead of the cutscene just unscrolling on the screen in front of you, they present story elements
within
an interactive situation. So you can look away from the person talking to you or not listen to them. Yeah. So you still feel like you're in control. I think Mark and Jan are making a very valid point. What needs to happen with story? There's two kinds of stories in games. There's the story that the designer, the developer has come up with, and then there's the story the player experiences. And we've currently got, and that story is based, the story the player experiences is based on what they choose to do.
Whether they're winning or losing.
Or whether they went into that room or this room, or whether they saved the princess or married the princess or whatever. Now, currently there's often
So you can't save and marry at the same time.
Of course you can. But no, currently there's often a clash between those two, because the auteurs are saying, I want to tell you this story, and the players are saying that's not necessarily my story. We need to have a situation where the storytelling from the developers is only 10% of the overall story the player experiences, instead of currently the story you experience is 50% or more, and then you've got little bits of interactivity between these huge cutscenes.
But we've talked about games like the old Pac-Man, that little yellow ball that ran around eating the white balls, or that Russian game Tetris, where you had to organise falling bricks into lines. And presumably they are still engaging for some people. I mean, what was the turning point when storytelling became an integral part of that experience? Mark Peschke, perhaps you could tell us.
Well, it happened sort of around the time of Tomb Raider, I suppose, is when games started to get very 3D, and it was possible because the game designers were creating literally worlds. I think that they started to get very strong ideas about the fact, well, this is a world, this is a movie, there should be a story in here. So you have games, Castle Wolfenstein, Tomb Raider, Doom, that start to have some story that allow you to drive the rationale for why the character is essentially blowing things up.
It's interesting bringing up a game like Doom, because I know that the guys who created that game were, like Mark, old role players, and their whole kind
that
of
old. Sorry, go on.
gamers from way back, and so their big design brief was that they wanted to give the player an experience as though there was a games master guiding him through this world. And though the technological limitations at the time, I think they succeeded quite
and
well.
And Doom is a good example, but yeah, I think we've gone too far now. For me, the turning point was sort of as Mark said, once the tech got to a certain level, you could both present valid gameplay and a bit of story. And then CDs, games came on CDs, and you could put video cutscenes on there. And from there, so it was pretty much, I think it was actually a technology-driven turning point that then became a creative avenue.
So you were an old role player, so you actually played
Dungeons
it in the real
Dragons.
World.
The real world.
I wrote non-digital world.
I wrote and edited, role-playing games where you sit around and put on funny voices and pretend to be an elf. That's a particularly bad example I've just given. I never did that, of course.
You have got a green top on, though. I can see you as an elf.
Yes. I've got my ranger scarf as well.
But this is a relatively new field. When you tell other writers that you write for games, do they get what you do? I mean, is that...
No. I've been to a number of writers' conferences. I give seminars. I've lectured at various places. And the most common misunderstanding, the most common horrific thing that happens to me is somebody saying, I'm writing a novel, I think it'd make a great game. And it's now gotten to the stage after years of me saying, you're just wrong, without even hearing the idea, because that's the wrong way to approach it.
What is the right way?
The right way is to, hopefully in synergy, but I would suggest that, the gameplay has to come first, to develop gameplay, work out the story that best supports that, and then develop them together. The right way is to think, what is a great snippet of gameplay, 1 minute of gameplay, and can I repeat it for 20 hours?
Now, tell me about this gameplay thing.
Well, gameplay is just running and jumping to get to the princess, or picking up the gun and shooting the monster in Halo. Or
so is it about strategy? Is it about skill? Is it about technique?
I think that's if you could answer that question definitively, I think that you'd have a really big company on your hands that would make really successful games, because I don't think people still, you know, people of sort of 30, late 20s still think really fondly back to games early on, which were pure gameplay and focus just on that, but no one can tell you why that particular game was better.
The definition
than what
of gameplay
I'm
depends
now.
On the game. There's a game called
and on the gamer.
There's a game called Myst, which you literally just said, "I'll go left and look at a pretty picture of an outdoor landscape, or I'll go right and look at a pretty picture of an interior room."
And people absolutely loved Myst, and yet to me, it was one of the most boring 5 minutes I've ever spent.
Why did they love it?
Sorry, I just want to point out, and I agree it was boring, but that choice is gameplay. All gameplay means, I used a big word, but I'm not a bit, you know, but it just means choice. So when you're in a cutscene, you have no choice. When you're out in the game world, you have choice.
And Myst was pure story, pure gameplay. There was no, you had almost nothing, you know, you could push a button maybe, or turn.
Yeah. Mm. People loved it. That was actually a pre-Sims case of The Sims, I think. Non-gamers bought that, and some of them bought machines to play it. There's cases of
a non-gamer and a gamer. What's the difference there?
Well, the non-gamer is the person who's going to play games casually, who's going to need something that really appeals to them, that's not so much dependent perhaps on the physical acuity of being able to twitch buttons and have a lot of eye-hand coordination, which tend to be skills that are really well-developed in the core gaming community.
Yeah, there are great games that normal humans can't access. And sometimes I encounter this as well. There are absolutely fantastic games, and you watch people play them and you know it's great. And you pick it up and I'm just too lame and I have to put it down after 5 minutes.
Too lame, like you can't physically...
Yeah, I just don't...
I'm not 12 years old.
The twitch coordination.
I'm not 12 years old.
Yeah, or even when I was 12, I wasn't that good. Yeah. But that's fine. Those games can appeal to that market.
But you see a lot of these games that come through, like the dancing sort of games, or the games where you need to sing and keep on pitch, sort of karaoke style...
Body games where you use your actual body, moving
Nintendogs on the DS, which is it's a game, but it's just a virtual pet that you have to feed and take for walks, which don't require any kind of skill really, apart from the things that we'd normally do in our life anyway.
Yeah. Right.
And then you have the Sony iToy, which is a little web camera that goes on to the PlayStation 2, which is this huge selling accessory, because it doesn't mean you have to learn how to press the buttons on the PlayStation controller. You can just move your body in front of the television set, and now you're interacting with the game.
You're on The Book Show on ABC Radio National with me, Ramona Koval, and I'm speaking with Jan Nabokowski and Mark Angeli and Mark Pesci about writing for games, writing for video games. Now, Mark Angeli, do you think that gamers have film envy?
Gamers don't, but the game industry has film envy like you cannot believe. I'm speechless with rage just remembering some of the meetings I've had.
Well, why? What happens?
Well, this designer decided that he wanted to represent his role-playing, his entire role-playing life from when he was 15 in a computer game, and it just didn't belong. He had hours and hours of cutscenes.
Hours and hours?
Literally hours of them, and I was hired to direct them and rewrite some of them. And we told him, you know, that... He only had the budget for 20 minutes, and then the cutscenes were rewritten, and they came down for two hours and blah, blah, blah. And the only reason for these to exist was because he wanted to be writing a film about him being an elf when he was 15. And it ended up not shipping. They cut the cutscenes out of the game. They cut the game right back. And that kind of thing happens all the time.
There's, I think, one principal reason that the gaming creators are so envious of film. It comes down to a very simple principle. So far, there's been no 3D game. There's maybe an example in one text game, but there's been no 3D game that can make you cry.
Are moved. I mean, you did describe being moved because you thought you were going to be tortured in one game.
Yes, and that means that we're starting to get close to it, but in terms of having that sort of overwhelming emotion, which isn't just sort of your adrenal gland pumping, but is something that's maybe a little bit more based in some sort of higher emotion, the kinds of things that would make a chick flick weepy, Those are the kinds of things that sometimes gamers are going for, or pardon me, the game designers are going for, and they can't seem to reach it.
Well, the other problem is that even if I designed that game now and had the entire budget to make it, it wouldn't be released. Even if there was a market for it, the publishers, the people who actually put the money behind games and release them, are afraid of those new markets.
Can we ever say that we're going to reach a point where games come to provide something that books can't?
They already do, I think. But it's not in the story. I've had moments in a game where I've said to a friend, you know, remember that great scene in the castle where you did X, Y, and Z? And the friend says, I didn't do that.
Yeah.
I did A, B, and C. And you've had two totally different experiences, which were both empowering and driven by you and told your own story, but they were radically different and you were in complete control. Books can't do that. I mean, yes, of course they can, because you can interpret things differently.
But people do basically read the same book. No two games of Tetris are going to be exactly the same. That's a really simple example, but...
Do gamers read books still?
That's, I mean, again, who's a gamer? I mean, I read books. I read a lot of books, but, you know, I also write.
There's a new... I think if you had asked that question 5 years ago, you could have said no, but there's a new kind of area of gamers who are much more culturally aware and culturally engaged. Games are only one part of their entertainment field, but they're pretty hardcore gamers still.
But I think that games are definitely coming up. It's like anything else that starts off as a niche, geek for want of a better word, media. And now that it's broken out, you know, people... There are football fans in America, or probably over here even, who will only buy the football game, and they will buy the same football game every year, and it's the only game they'll ever play. But you could call them gamers.
And I'll never have to write a story for a football game.
Right. Exactly.
Right, because it's all about them empowering themselves to write their own story about what their teams are doing.
Yeah,
exactly. And that is a very good example of, you know, watching the Super Bowl and having the team that you weren't backing win, and then going through and playing it through the game. And
so
having your team
win, yeah.
And with you as coach. So,
well, I'm really glad that we've had this conversation. I feel completely enlightened now. And thank you to you all. Mark Angeli, a video game writer and director, and the co-founder of a game design consultancy, The Game Mechanics, and Jan Napakowski, who's been a gamer. She currently works as a freelance writer for the LA-based development house Space Dog, who specialise in adapting comics to other media. And Mark Pesci, author of The Playful World. Thank you all very much for being on The Book Show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Background Briefing is Radio National's investigative current affairs documentary program, first heard each Sunday morning. However, you can also listen to Background Briefing whenever you want, wherever you want. Radio National's free podcasting service means that you can have each week's program automatically sent to your personal computer. Then either listen to the program at your PC or download to your portable MP3 player. For step-by-step instructions, log on to abc.net.au/rn.
Now it's time for a book review. If you're around-the-clock Radio National listener, you would have heard English actor Richard E. Grant on Movie Time last night speaking with Julie Rigg, but you might not have realised his new movie, Wawa, was released in conjunction with a book, his diary actually, an up-close and personal account of the filmmaking process. Richard E. Grant has appeared in over 30 films, but Wawa is his first as a director, a process which took him 5 years to complete. For The Book Show, here's Kate Bochner, who hasn't seen the film yet, but who loves other people's diaries.
I've been reading The Wawa Diaries, The Making of a Film, by Richard E. Grant. To be perfectly honest, this is not a very Radio National book. It's a diary of the process of making the film Wawa, by the film's writer and director, who also happens to be a very well-known English actor. Yes, it does bring to mind visions of Ponzi actors wildly emoting over quite simple problems, faced and solved every hour by the rest of us. But that would be unfair. There is some of that. But Richard E. Grant is a serious-minded individual with a gift for language and a perfectly grown-up degree of self-awareness. His diary is an interesting account of a creative activity that requires passion, patience, a great deal of technical skill, and an enormous amount of energy. Does the name Richard E. Grant mean anything to you? He's appeared in something like 30 films, so you're bound to know his face, as they say. And you've probably caught him on TV over the last couple of weeks as he's made appearances on all the Australian talk shows. I first saw him in the 1987 English low-budget film Whitnell and I, and like many of us, I've been a big fan ever since. Whitnell and I is the story of two young underemployed actors, one diligent, careful, responsible, totally forgettable, the other filthy, disrespectful, aimless, bored, angry, drunk, drug-addled, enigmatic and totally charismatic. Richard E. Grant was this man. Decked out in shabby, foppish garments and a long coat, his blue eyes piercing through the grime of his face, he was totally compelling. It was his first big role. Or you may have seen Richard E. Grant on ABC TV as the Scarlet Pimpernel, or as the increasingly drunken Simon Marchmount, wayward husband of Minty, bringing extraordinary food to ordinary people in the BBC's remarkable Posh Nosh. He's a master of self-parody. His Wawa Diaries are suffused with his hallmark camp comic style. The making of a film, even a low-budget one, is clearly a long and winding road with many potholes. Ours is such a visual culture. We watch films endlessly, and many of us dabble in the filmmaking process now that cameras are cheap and editing systems are installed on every second home PC. But why would a successful actor, a film star really, although at one point he describes himself as a ponce for hire, why would he want to get his hands dirty by crossing over to the other side of the camera? In this case, the answer lies in our diarist's commitment to the story. This film is Richard E. Grant's story. His mother deserted him and his father when Richard was 10 after committing adultery with Richard's father's best friend in the front seat of a car while Richard lay asleep in the back. His father succumbed to alcoholism, which manifested itself in violent rages. On one occasion, Richard found himself being chased about the garden by his father with a loaded revolver. His father actually made an attempt to shoot Richard, missed, turned the gun on himself, and collapsed into tears. This series of domestic tragedies took place in Swaziland, where Richard was born and grew up. His father was a colonial official. Richard has inherited his pith helmet. How exotic. And you'd never guess it to hear him speak. How do they do that? I can't say, but I do know how he keeps his youthful figure in his late 40s. He gets up every morning at dawn and runs for 40 minutes. I'm impressed by his self-discipline and his forbearance. Many of us wouldn't have made it past childhood in one piece, let alone have the strength to revisit those events in such a public way. It's interesting to read about the problems of the novice film director. The diaries take us from the lunch at the Ivy in London in October 1999, where a producer told him to write the script, through to the film's opening at the Edinburgh Festival in September 2005. And this wasn't one of those jobs where the director sweeps in once everything's in place. Money, locations, cast, crew, costumes, catering, accommodation, you name it, Richard contributed to its organisation. He even gathered up props in flea markets and junk shops on several continents. It sounds as though he might have quite an extensive collection of 1950s binoculars. The filming bit was quite familiar to our diarist, but the editing process was a revelation. His description of what went on between himself as director and the French producer is a portrait of an utterly dysfunctional relationship. As anyone with a job would, I had moments of totally amused empathy, but much of the time I cringed like I do when I watch The Office. Richard, my sympathies. Getting money to make a film requires luck, patience, and excellent administrative skills, because funding bodies and backers attach all sorts of strings to their contributions. Someone needs to convince actors to commit to a project which isn't funded yet. The actors must have reputations big enough to pull a crowd and egos small enough to work for realistic prices. This job fell to our diarist because he had the charm and the contacts and the passion for the project. Why do we read diaries? Because we want to know how things really work and what makes people tick, and we love gossip. We read the diaries of Winston Churchill, say, to find out what was going on in the mind of the man who sent our fathers and grandfathers into battle. We read the diaries of British Conservative politician Alan Clark to get the goss on his famous philandering and his dealings with Mrs. Thatcher. We read the diaries of Adrian Mole because we see our 13-year-old selves in them, speaking strictly for myself. Whatever they reveal, they can't be dreary and they can't be pompous. The Wawa Diaries are neither. They're an entertaining record of a process which is all too common but still mysterious. And if you're at all curious about how a film gets made, this is the book for you. And although I wouldn't want to see Richard E. Grant give up being in films, I hope he has the energy to write and direct another one. Next time, I hope he finds a more cooperative producer, though.
Kate Bochner there with her thoughts on the Wawa Diaries by Richard E. Grant, which is published by Picador. And if the movie isn't on in a cinema near you, it very soon will be. And you can check out the website of Movie Time for Julie Riggs' film review. And thanks today to the producers of the program, to the Book Show producers, Rhiannon Brown, Lynn Gallagher, Maria Zylstra, Michael Sheriffs, and our intern this week, Nikolai Bahlhartz, and technical operator, Martin Lawrence. And on Sunday night, back by popular demand, you'll be able to hear again our discussion of postmodernism and the way it has crept into school subjects. And on Monday, Colm Toibean, winner of this year's Impact Dublin Literary Award. We'll hear again a conversation about his award-winning novel, The Master. So make a note of that for Monday at 10. And on Tuesday, we meet the 2004 Impact Award winner, Tahar Beljeloun, the Moroccan author of This Blinding Absence of Light, and recently The Last Friend. And that's all from me, Ramona Koval. See you Sunday night and then Monday. Hope you have a fantastic weekend. Bye for now.